Islamic, but it's okay for him to turn to any person in authority to just take back what he thinks he's
lost.
Right.
Yes, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on Iran Radio. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on Iran Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws concerning Israeli products. Based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. And let's continue with the questions, Sheikh. The question I'd like to ask you is that, you know, some Muslims basically live in non-Islamic states, as we all know, right?
Yes.
So is it actually permissible for Muslims living mostly in non-Islamic states or governments or countries basically to buy goods, buy installments for a price that is higher than the cash price? And does this amount to riba or usury?
Well, there is no objection in selling and buying goods by installments for more than the cash price. And this is currently the way people can buy things. Otherwise, they don't have cash in their pockets. And the difference is not considered riba, the extra amount of money that is taken by installments is not considered to be riba or usury or whatever you may call it.
Mm-hmm. I see. Sheikh Javid, is it permissible to import Israeli goods and advertise them? If there is no other choice, is it permissible to sell such goods?
Well, it is forbidden to embark on any dealings that may serve the interests of the state of Israel, which obviously harbors enmity towards Islam and Muslims, mm-hmm. and which is killing Muslims, innocent Palestinians, mm-hmm. and children, women, especially in these days and in this time around. Since, for example, maybe more than 1 year, it has been killing innocent Palestinians. So it's not permissible for anyone to import and promote Israeli goods and of course, Israeli products or sell them, which at the end of the day benefits the Israelis. And it's not permissible for Muslims to buy such goods because it entails bad effects and is obviously detrimental to Islam and Muslims, because the more goods you buy, Israeli goods you buy, the more benefits they earn, the more gains they make. So it's Israel that will definitely benefit from its goods which are sold in Muslim countries. Mm-hmm. So it's necessary, just as His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khomeini time and again have stated clearly, that it is necessary for Muslims to avoid buying Israeli goods and also to help Muslims, Palestinians, and the resistance and the axis of resistance in any manner possible to in their struggle against Israel.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take another break and then we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on Iran Radio. Don't go away. Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on Iran Radio with me, Mohammad Javad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws concerning the Israeli products based on fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, is it permissible for merchants or traders and business people to import and promote Israeli goods in a country that has lifted the boycott of Israeli goods?
Well, just like I said in my answer to the previous question, it is necessary for the merchants to refrain from importing and promoting goods whose production and selling would benefit the deplorable state of Israel. Mm. So anything that contributes towards funding and the Israeli army, helping the state of Israel, must be refrained, must be actually avoided.
I see. Well, is it permissible for Muslims to buy Israeli goods that are on offer in a Muslim country?
Well, it is incumbent on every Muslim to refrain from buying and making use of goods whose production and sale would benefit the Zionists who are at war with Islam and Muslims. And this is the position of all religious authorities. No Muslim should allow himself to import such goods or to buy such goods which will otherwise help the Israeli government and the Israeli state of Israel.
Is it permissible, Sheikh Javid, to set up travel agencies in Muslim lands with a view to selling tickets for trips or travel to Israel? And is it permissible for Muslims to buy tickets from such agencies?
Well, it's not permissible, according to His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, for any Muslim to buy such tickets or to go to such agencies, because it is detrimental to Islam and Muslims. And it's not permissible for anyone to do anything that may constitute a kind of violation of the Muslim boycott of Israel, which is the obviously the enemy of Muslims, and which is at war with Muslims. So the boycott must be maintained. And just as they are boycotting our products, just as they do not buy our products and try to impose sanctions on Muslim countries, especially Iran, as we see, we should also do the same. When it comes to the state of Israel, we should not do anything that helps Israel.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid, for your nice contribution to this program, Islamic Laws on Iran Radio, in which we try to deal with some of the jurisprudential laws or Islamic laws regarding Israeli products based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. From me, Mohammad Javad, the host of this program, Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker, and the rest of the crew, we bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
لا إله إلا ilaha illa hu.
Black and white.
Para poder comprender.
To understand why China plays such a crucial and essential role in the international arena, it is necessary to take a brief step back in time, perhaps to a period that some may even consider contemporary.
Quizás para algunos incluso llega a ser contemporáneo.
This was the awakening of a nation that transformed its identity and moved beyond a century marked by humiliation.
Y al dejar atrás el siglo de las humillaciones.
The establishment of the People's Republic of China in 1949, under the leadership of historical figures such as Mao Zedong, Zhou Enlai, Kang Chen, Chen Peta, Liu Shaoqi, and many others, marked a significant turning point. In the meantime, the Kuomintang, or the right-wing faction, backed by the United States, fled the mainland and took refuge on an island, Taiwan. From there, they declared themselves the government of all of China, calling themselves the Republic of China.
Y ahí tenemos la República Popular China.
Today, we have the People's Republic of China, with a population of over 1.4 billion, and an island, Taiwan, known as the Republic of China, home to 20 million people. One is under the protection of the United States, while the other stands independently, playing a significant role on the international stage.
Fue la lucha contra el colonialismo, el imperialismo.
This was part of the struggle against colonialism, imperialism, and the Japanese and later American imperialism.
Para el sur profundo, o para los pueblos que antes se llamaban el tercer mundo.
These days, China plays a crucial role in the economy, especially for the Deep South and regions once labeled as the Third World. They are promoting a new initiative, the Silk Road, along with a unique approach to trade that emphasizes mutual benefit without exploiting others. This has left American imperialism scratching its head in disbelief.
Se tira los cabellos.
Kissinger's team wonders how they didn't see this coming. The Chinese were clever, maintaining their sovereignty and independence while still being led by the Communist Party. Moreover, the People's Liberation Army, which serves as the armed forces of the People's Republic of China, does not answer to the Chinese state, but solely to the Central Committee of the Communist Party. How did we overlook that? Kissinger pondered, well, the Chinese are patient and have a clear sense of purpose. These days, they are part of the BRICS, an organization that undeniably plays a crucial role in deglobalization of the world, particularly in terms of economic independence, which is fundamental for the political autonomy of nations.
Para la independencia política de los pueblos. China está junto a Cuba, junto a Palestina.
China stands alongside Cuba, Palestine, Nicaragua, Venezuela, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, Russia, and the Islamic Republic of Iran. They conduct joint military exercises and collaborate without much noise, but China is increasingly asserting a stronger position. The voice of China is also becoming more prominent. It's important to remember that there was a time when China toned down its rhetoric while building its strength to reemerge on the international stage as a new kind of great power.
Levantarse del escenario internacional como una gran potencia de nuevo tipo.
Don't overlook that phrase, new kind, as democracy in China is referred to as new type of democracy.
Para oponerse. A la llamada democracia.
Contrasting with what is often called democracy in the West, which is essentially the power of the few over the majority, representing the interests of the financial oligarchy.
Hoy día, China es importante para todos.
Today, China holds significant importance for all nations around the globe, and we should continue to study this existence, as it will likely remain relevant for many years to come. This is Black and White. I'm Eduardo Artes.
Soy Eduardo Artes. Hoy, nadie pone en duda la importancia de la República Popular China.
Today, no one questions the significance of the People's Republic of China across various fields, such as economics, culture, politics, and military affairs. Its global relationships are vast and diverse, engaging with different governments worldwide, regardless of their ideological or political beliefs. China is often referred to as a superpower, with predictions suggesting it may surpass the United States by 2035. An interesting historical note is that in 1970, one of Salvador Allende's first actions was to establish diplomatic relations with the People's Republic of China, making Chile the second country in the Americas to do so, following Cuba. In 1971, China also became a member of the United Nations.
Con la República Popular China, segundo país de América, estoy diciendo, de toda América, que abre relaciones con la República Popular China.
To delve into the past briefly and focus on China's current significance and role on the international stage, we have a very special guest. Joining us from Venezuela is Sergio Rodriguez, the former Director of International Relations for the Venezuelan Presidency, who holds a degree in International Studies and a Master's in International Relations from the Central University of Venezuela. Sergio has been in Chile to present his book, China in the 21st Century, The Awakening of a Giant. Welcome, Sergio, to our program, Black and White.
Bienvenido, Sergio, a nuestro programa Negro y Blanco por Hispan TV.
Muchas gracias, Eduardo. Muchas gracias por la invitación.
Thank you so much, Eduardo. I really appreciate the invitation. It's always a pleasure to discuss these topics and share insights about the fascinating and often unfamiliar world of China.
¿Qué es China?
Sergio, brevemente te voy a leer una cita de Deng Xiaoping.
Sergio, I'd like to share a quote from Deng Xiaoping from the 1990s to see if it is still holding true today or if we have moved beyond his ideas. In his work, 24-Character Strategy, Deng Xiaoping advised these: observe calmly, secure our position, conceal our capabilities, buy time, maintain a low profile, and never claim leadership. This was his approach during the 90s to navigate the challenges of that era. Has this stance been surpassed? Nowadays, China is certainly not uncertain on the global stage and has moved away from a low profile. What is China's current position?
There are several angles to consider when interpreting Deng Xiaoping's statement. I believe it's essential to approach it from a strategic perspective rather than just a situational analysis. This viewpoint reflects a deeper philosophical thought and a broader paradigm. I often say that studying China isn't just about examining a country. It's about understanding a civilization. In the field of international relations, we typically analyze countries using specific categories, but with China, those categories fall short. It's clear to me that there's a vast and profound way of thinking that draws heavily from the past while also looking ahead to the future. In philosophical terms, regarding the mindset that shapes China's behavior today, this concept is indeed present and will always be, as it has been throughout history. The Chinese constitution, particularly in its preamble, emphasizes the fight against hegemonism. Throughout my numerous trips to China, around 12 or 13, I've never once heard anyone express a desire to become the leading power to surpass the United States or to achieve global dominance. In essence, there is no intention of competition in China. The idea of being first or second in any regard is a Western notion that simply doesn't exist in their perspective. They have a project, a long-term project. They have goals, they have an objective, and they are fulfilling it. And indeed, in a period of history which you referred to in 1990, let us think about what was happening in the world in 1990. The Soviet Union had disappeared, the bipolar world had disappeared, and clearly at that moment, right at that moment, is when the West began to understand that China is their strategic enemy. And in the face of that, Xi Jinping says that we have to go unnoticed, we have to develop, and that is what they have done. But to repeat, it must be seen on two levels. One, which is that they will continue to do so because it has to do with their DNA, with their way of behaving. But contradictorily, or dialectically contradictory, is that today they're playing a more important, more relevant role on the international stage.
Más importante, más relevante en el escenario internacional.
Lo que tú estás planteando, Sergio.
What you're suggesting, Sergio, could we relate that to China's approach towards a shared future for humanity? Let's take a short break and then we'll continue.
Continua.
We're here with Sergio Rodriguez, who has come from Venezuela, and we're diving into a discussion about China. Sergio, we still need to touch on the concept of a shared future, which relates to China's non-hegemonic intentions, right? This includes aspects like South-South cooperation and more.
Sí, en un primer momento.
Yes, initially China aimed to discuss a shared future within its immediate surroundings. They sought to foster collaborative development with neighboring countries to ensure peace and stability along their borders, gradually reducing conflicts to enhance their regional influence. Now this concept has evolved, and they're promoting the idea of building a shared future for all of humanity on a global scale. This brings us to a different kind of discussion regarding China's strategic vision and its future direction. After conducting extensive research, which included writing a book over 4 years and making 8 trips to China, I've explored 15 provinces. For instance, I spent 10 days in a remote area, 4.5 hours by plane from Shanghai, near the borders with Pakistan and Kyrgyzstan, where I didn't encounter any Westerners. This region is rarely visited by tourists or researchers who typically do investigations about Shanghai and Beijing and study them. Having experienced this deeper side of China, I am convinced that the country is moving towards socialism.
Después de conocer la China profunda, yo no tengo ninguna duda que China va hacia el socialismo.
A socialism with Chinese characteristics. This is also very important, as it has been one of the discussions among the elites. But the point is that China does not simply copy and paste. It actually adapts the general principles to their own reality.
Claro, desde tiempo.
Certainly, since the time of Mao and even before the establishment of the People's Republic of China, there was a clear intention among the leaders, particularly President Mao Zedong, to recognize that the success of a socialist project in China depended on integrating it with ancient Chinese philosophical thought. This may seem obvious, but upon delving into the depth of Marxism, one realizes that it is not a rigid doctrine. Rather, it requires adaptation to the unique conditions of each country. However, this approach was set aside during this period, and China faced significant resistance to maintaining its natural conditions. Initially, the Chinese acknowledged having a strong relationship with Stalin, but after his death, 4 years following the Chinese Revolution, Nikita Khrushchev emerged with the intent to impose the Soviet model. This was met with resistance, leading to significant contradictions in the early years.
Y eso lo resistieron, y ahí empezaron las grandes contradicciones que significó el rompimiento.
Absolutamente. Stalin planteaba que eran los principios generales.
Certainly. Stalin argued that general principles should be applied according to reality. Take China today, for instance. It plays a significant role on the global stage, but faces an internal contradiction regarding the reunification of Taiwan. How does this create tension for world peace? This is what the dominant Western media suggests.
Porque esto nos dicen los medios hegemónicos occidentales.
Claro, cuando tú analizas el último presupuesto militar de Estados Unidos.
Sure, when you look at the last U.S. military budget, you'll find that it allocates $61 billion for Ukraine, around $25 billion for Israel, and $19 billion for Taiwan.
Y en consecuencia, ojo, que Estados Unidos...
The United States acknowledges that there is only one China and officially recognizes the government in Beijing, not the one in Taipei.
De Taipei.
Claro, pero cuando tú analizas este presupuesto...
Certainly. When you take a look at this budget, you can easily identify the key points of tension around the world. There are two hot spots currently boiling over, Ukraine and Palestine, while another situation is simmering beneath the surface. Right now, it's quite challenging for the United States to manage a military conflict on three global fronts, especially when facing two of the three largest military powers. What you're highlighting relates to a global phenomenon where there is a blatant disregard for the international system, its standards, and international law, and this contradicts with the claims made by the U.S. and the West to create a rules-based international order. And what rules are those? The ones they themselves define them. We find ourselves in a moment of paradigm shift, a strategic confrontation where one system is fading away and another is emerging. And this is evident in conflicts worldwide. It can be seen in Venezuela, in Africa, and in various other conflicts. Why is it so significant in the case of Taiwan? Because you're dealing with a superpower, a nuclear power, with immense economic strength, which presents a greater challenge for the United States and the West. This is similar to the situation with Russia, which has vast energy reserves, and China, with its substantial economic potential. Together, they're working to create a different international system based on principles like solidarity, cooperation, and mutual benefit, which contrasts with the capitalist model that has been dominant since the end of the Cold War.
Basado, sustentado en otros parámetros, la solidaridad, la cooperación, el ganar-ganar, etc., que rompe el modelo capitalista impuesto desde el fin de la
Segunda. Aprovechando que tú has estado en la China profunda, según el Banco Mundial, en los últimos tres decenios, en los últimos 30 años...
It's great to hear that you have been to deep China. According to the World Bank, over the past 30 years, China has lifted 900 million people out of poverty. What is China like today in terms of poverty levels? Since you have traveled extensively, could you share your insights on this?
Has viajado por todos lados, por favor, explícanos sobre eso.
Bueno, sí, el modelo chino de lucha contra la pobreza hoy es un modelo adoptado por Naciones Unidas.
The Chinese model for combating poverty has become a framework that the United Nations is now looking to implement globally. Chinese significant impact on the world's population means that the UN can proudly claim a reduction in global poverty, largely due to the progress made in China and to a lesser extent in India. Both countries, being highly populated, play a crucial role in these statistics. Unlike models that rely on subsidies or artificial state support, China's approach focuses on backing productive projects and actively involving the government in effective poverty alleviation. An important yet often overlooked aspect is that the fight against poverty in China was largely driven by the Communist Party, with 3 million party members participating in these efforts. Tragically, over 37,000 of these members lost their lives in the battle against poverty. When Xi Jinping was appointed as the General Secretary of the party in 2012, there were about 100 million people living in poverty. He set a goal to eradicate poverty by 2021, coinciding with the 100th anniversary of the Communist Party's founding, and they achieved this goal a year early in 2020. Now, the next strategic objective is to reach 2049, marking the century of the People's Republic of China, with the aim of eliminating not just extreme poverty, but all forms of poverty. The vision is to transform China into a country characterized by moderate development, harmony with nature, and significant cultural and social advancement, essentially a fully middle-class nation.
Diríamos en términos occidentales un país de clase media, totalmente de clase media. Ahora,
now, with just a minute left, let's quickly touch on China and the BRICS.
Bueno, China tiene un papel determinante.
China plays a crucial role in the BRICS platform, which seems to be a key link in the development of a new international system. This system is based on different values and behaviors and aligned more closely with the aspirations of the majority of humanity, such as solidarity and cooperation. It focuses on utilizing resources to tackle the most pressing issues facing people today. In this context, China's economic strength, experience, and rich cultural and historical background are being leveraged to support the establishment of BRICS and other initiatives like the Belt and Road Initiative, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. Together, these organizations aimed to create a better and different world.
Sergio, it's been a pleasure having you with us here on Black and White. We truly appreciate your presence and wish you all the best with your book. We're confident it'll be a great success in Chile and beyond. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales, Roundtable Discussions, Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
According to eyewitnesses who spoke to the Geneva-based Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor in a new report, Israeli military have carried out field executions of Palestinians in northern Gaza. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Middle East Eye has covered this story and tells us more. A major European rights body recounts in harrowing detail the atrocities that have been carried out for the past 2 months by the Israeli military against Palestinians in northern Gaza Strip. The Geneva-based Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor provided the information in a report on Monday, 18th of November. The report showed how the Israeli military had been subjecting the Gazans to direct killings, extrajudicial executions, mass starvation, and ethnic cleansing with no justification whatsoever as part of its now 13-month-old genocidal war in the coastal sliver. The report noted that Israeli forces have been committing the crimes by bombing homes with residents inside, committing mass killings against displaced civilians in shelters, and targeting gatherings and vehicles. It said the Israeli military have also embarked on bringing about the largest cases of forced displacement in modern history against the targeted civilians. The Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor stated that the period in question, throughout which the Israeli military has markedly intensified its deadly aggression against northern Gaza, has seen it conducting its third incursion and military offensive against the targeted areas and committing heinous atrocities. It added the combined killing and displacement routine was being carried out with the aim of terrorizing civilians, among other things. The Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor cited Tamam Abdel-Mokaddemeh, one of the civilians, as describing some of the atrocities that the Israeli military committed in the city of Beit Lahia in northern Gaza. Abdel-Mokaddemeh said conditions worsened in the Al-Shama street in Beit Lahia due to heavy artillery and aerial bombardment. As a result, we moved from our home near Al-Shama clinic to the Abbas Kilani area in the middle of Al-Shama street. Abdel-Mokaddemeh added, on Wednesday, 13th of November, Israeli occupation forces began advancing into the area where we were sheltering. We stayed trapped in the house, and less than 2 hours later, Israeli military blew open the door and stormed the building. He added, when we descended on the ground floor on the orders of the Israeli military, I find my brother-in-law Khaled lying dead with 2 gunshot wounds to his abdomen, blood streaming from him. My eldest son, Ibrahim, 21, had been shot in the head. He added, when we came down to the ground floor on the orders of the Israeli military, I find my brother-in-law Khaled lying dead with 2 gunshot wounds to his abdomen with blood streaming from him. His eldest son, Ibrahim, 21 years old, had also been shot in the head. I stood in shock for moments before a soldier threatened me to move or be shot. We were about 26 people in total. He noted how her sister was prevented by the invading troops from saying goodbye to her husband and son and would keep crying. They executed them in front of me, as Mokaddemeh and others were trying to pull her away. Describing the manner of the victim's execution, he added, they killed them without them moving a muscle. Mokaddemeh's sister said, this happened in front of the small children, 4 boys and 4 girls, who witnessed their father and brother executed before their eyes. Meanwhile, according to the Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor, the Israeli military has been preventing civil defense and medical teams from accessing the victims, including those who have been buried under the rubble in northern Gaza for the past 2 months. Beit Lahia has turned into a specific target of the campaign for the past 2 weeks, with the Israeli military pushing some 5,000 civilians there into various gathering points and targeting those who would try to return to their homes to retrieve desperately needed food, which is unavailable at the gathering sites. A civilian said, dozens who attempted to do so or bring back food have not returned as they were executed in the streets. Another described the condition in which he had found one of the victims who had tried to return with some food, adding, beside one of the victims, there was a bag of flour. It seems he had successfully retrieved it from his home, but the Israeli army shot him as he was returning to the shelter. He said of the dire nutritional conditions at the gathering locations, any food we manage to secure from nearby homes is distributed primarily to children, followed by the elderly in smaller portions. Young adults receive, at best, a single loaf of bread per day. Meanwhile, the human rights body denounced the international community's reluctance to take decisive action against the Israeli regime, which has claimed the lives of nearly 44,000 Palestinians, many of them women and children, during its October of 2023 to present-day genocide or war in Gaza. It lamented the inaction of the international community, making it complicit in these crimes, and granting the Israeli regime a green light to escalate its genocide. This also reflects a shocking disregard for the lives and dignity of Palestinians. The international system, including the International Criminal Court, the ICC, and the European Union, and various United Nations bodies, have collectively failed to achieve the fundamental goals and principles upon which they were founded. The website Relief Web has also covered the same story and tells us more. The International Rescue Committee said throughout the course of the Israeli war against Palestinians in Gaza, human rights and relief institutions have demonstrated a disgraceful failure to protect civilians and halt the genocide Israel is perpetrating against Palestinians in Gaza, a duty that lies at the core of their mission and existence. The International Rescue Committee is demanding humanitarian aid be allowed to enter northern Gaza, where the Israeli military renewed a brutal military assault and imposed an all-out siege last month. In a statement released on Monday, 18th of November, the International Rescue Committee said humanitarian aid must be allowed to enter immediately in light of the latest findings by the Global Hunger Monitor, an internationally recognized standard known as the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, or IPC. The report, which was issued by the IPC Famine Review Committee 2 weeks ago, said starvation and a widespread scarcity of food is likely imminent in the area. The International Rescue Committee said the report marked a sharp and alarming deterioration since last month's report, which projected a tripling in the number of people facing food shortages in the coming months. The International Rescue Committee said the worst-case scenario may already be underway. Across Gaza, starvation, malnutrition, and excess mortality due to malnutrition and disaster are rapidly increasing. The situation is critical. We have days, not weeks, to take decisive action to alleviate these dire conditions. The International Rescue Committee said in a statement, the Israeli regime must fulfill its obligations to ensure that people across Gaza can have access to food, medical supplies and other basic necessities needed for the survival of the population. Lives are now hanging in the balance.
I want to ask you a question. Look over here. Do you see a Holocaust coming? It's crazy. There's so much hunger, so much starvation in the world. So many people are suffering. And you want me to get excited about some idiot painting a swastika somewhere?
Finkelstein lost his job at the university because of what he claims was pressure from the Israeli lobby. Then he was denied entry to Israel because he was, as the authorities described, a security hazard, which being Jewish himself is probably unprecedented. Finkelstein reminds me of the biblical prophets of doom, who were always being pelted with stones for saying things nobody wanted to hear.
One of the major kind of claims I hear from people like the ADL or, you know, other Jewish people is that, like, how come always people picking up on Israel? How come there are so much, you know, injustice, you know, in other parts of the world, and nobody speaks about, you know? What is the reason for that?
I think people, listen, I open the radio, I hear nonstop about Sudan. I hear nonstop about Tibet. I hear nonstop about Darfur. I hear a lot. The only place I hear excuses made for is Israel. That's the place where I hear excuses. And we do have to remember, it is the oldest occupation in the world. I mean, 40 years really is enough. It's older than you. It's older than you, the occupation. Doesn't that kind of stun you?
Palestine, our ancient and unforgettable homeland. The Jews who seek this land will find their country. We will finally live freely in our soil and die peacefully in our homes. In the late 19th century, when Austrian journalist Theodor Herzl wrote these words in his book, The Jewish State, even his most optimistic Zionist supporters might not have imagined that they would have a country in Palestine 50 years later. Herzl was born a Jew, but had no belief in Jewish religious tenets. He grew up in Europe and was more influenced by the Enlightenment principles of Europe than the Jewish tradition. He believed in separating religion from politics and championed democracy as his ultimate goal. Jewish law had no place in the state Herzl envisioned. His emphasis was solely on ethnicity and race. The idea of partitioning and state building was a tactic employed by Britain, a colonial power, in the early 20th century. By using this tactic, Britain aimed to weaken the Ottoman Empire in West Asia, thereby perpetuating its own dominance and securing its resources. The creation of the Zionist regime was, in essence, a strategy to safeguard Western interests against the Islamic world. The Western government's plans to carve up Islamic territories was realized through the Sykes-Picot Agreement, paving the way for the Zionist movement to facilitate Jewish immigration into occupied lands. In 1917, British Foreign Secretary Arthur James Balfour supported the idea of Palestine becoming a homeland for Jews. This declaration, known as the Balfour Declaration, was a letter from the British Foreign Office addressed to Lord Rothschild, a prominent Zionist supporter. The declaration stated the British government's support for the establishment of a national home for Jews in Palestine.
The soldiers, British soldiers, screaming, pushing us with the guns, faster, faster, faster. And they pushed us from that boat to a cattle car. We were like sardines, standing, no bench, no chair, no one window. And the wagon stopped here, and here again, one, two, three, four, five. And we were pushed into these heads, surrounded with a fence. Again a fence. We are inside, soldiers, guns, counting us. We are numbers, not human beings. No one name, only numbers. I looked at my brother and asked him, this is what you promised to me? Is this the promised land?
During the years following World War II, while engaging in the genocide of Palestinians, the Zionists, in collaboration with the U.S., facilitated the continued immigration
of Jews to Palestine. Their utmost effort was to ease the immigration of Jews from all corners of the world to occupied Palestine, a goal that gave meaning to their ideology. According to statistics published by the Asharq al-Assad on March 19, 2020, number of Palestinians within occupied territories in 1948 was close to 900,000. Israel displaced the number of them after the 1948 war to reach a population of approximately 100,000.
There's a lot of sympathy that can be generated, and I think rightly so, for what Jewish people as a whole have dealt with in Western societies and globally because of anti-Semitism. The question then becomes, what is the proper response to that? The Zionist answer is, of course, statehood. And there's many people who would sympathize with that if it was, in fact, done in a vacuum and if it was, in fact, done for a people without a land in a land without people. The reality is that's just not the way that it happened. There were people here. They lost their homes, their livelihood, their nation, their everything.
This was a land in 1910 that was 93% Palestinian Arab and 6-7% Jewish. How did it suddenly become 80% Jewish and 20% Palestinian? This was not a normal demographic transition. This was a consequence of Israel's desire to create a Jewish state, and to do that it had to get rid of as many Palestinians as possible. There's other more complex factors, but that's cutting it to its bare bones as we see it.
That is, I think, in a certain sense, the core of the conflict. The Palestinians have suffered inordinately as a result of the creation of Israel. The creation of a Jewish state in a country that had an Arab majority necessarily and inevitably caused them irreparable harm.
Do you see Palestinians as a demographic threat to Israel? Do you use that language?
It does not respond to the original plans of Zionism.
What proportion of the Israeli population in an ideal world, in Shlomo Ben Ami's ideal, would be Palestinian?
It's
an important question. If you're going to talk about demography, how many Palestinians is too many?
I can't say that. I don't know.
If it was 51% Palestinian, would that be a problem for you as a liberal Zionist?
I guess not, but as a whole, the state needs to have a Jewish majority because that was the initial idea. This is the central ideology.
You're contradicting yourself. You're saying, I guess not to 51%, but the state needs to have a Jewish majority.
You are discussing with me mathematics. I'm talking about the principle.
In a Jewish state with a quote-unquote demographic threat, or demographic race is the phrase you use in your book, how many Palestinians is too many?
How many Muslims do you want in Britain? You're trying to turn Israel as a special case.
It is a special case.
Okay.
It's the only democracy that defines itself on ethnic grounds.
But there are others that do not define, but do it in practice.
In practice, okay. Yeah. Let me...
For example, the Arab world is... Arab states are not Muslims?
I don't think the Arab states have ever claimed to be Western liberal democracies.
The Israeli regime has always considered Palestinians inside to be a threat. This regime has made extensive efforts to sever Palestinians from their Arab cultural roots and assimilate them into Israeli society. However, the Palestinians, through their resistance, aim to teach their children about Palestinian history and the importance of preserving it. Now, the population of Palestinians within the occupied territories has surpassed 1,900,000, representing 21% of the inhabitants of occupied territories. More than seven decades ago, Ben-Gurion warned, "To ensure Palestinians never return, we must do everything we can." Ben-Gurion reassured his Zionist followers that Palestinians will never reclaim their homes. He asserted, "The elderly will die and the young will forget." The alarm bell for the Zionists has sounded as the Arab minority population is growing at an unprecedented rate, nearing a population equal to to that of the Jews living in Israel. The Israeli regime has made considerable efforts to change the demographic makeup of the region, but populations of the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, and Arabs living in occupied territories are still on par with the number of Jews living in the area. The Palestinians of Al-Quds have risen from the ashes, standing firm against Judaization and racism, resisting Israel's efforts to swallow their land and their identity. The Zionist regime has strived for 7 decades to eliminate the Palestinians, yet they remain in Palestine, even if a single unified state bearing that name has not been established.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وصي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of remembrance of God or Dhikrullah, based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. We are currently focusing on the 222nd sermon of Imam Ali alayhi salam, where he discusses about remembrance of God, dhikr of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. In the previous session, we were discussing about the reasons why a person would remember God. And we said that one of the reasons is when a person recognizes that he has some needs. One of those needs are material needs. When a person requires something, he knows the source of that need, the source of solving that need is there, and he will attend to that person. This is when a person needs another, and therefore he pays attention to the person who will alleviate that need. And after all, God is the one that solves all the needs of people. And then we say there are others who recognize that they have spiritual needs, and they then remember God because he's the one who is going to solve their spiritual needs. But then we discussed of a higher level of reasoning, which is the reasoning of love, that we shall discuss in this session.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali
Nahjul Balagha, also known as the Peak of Eloquence,